He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
On Voices today, we hear from a refugee who was plucked from the ravages of the Gulf War, only to find herself back in the Middle East as a teenager, being forced to marry against her will. But she's now made it back to New Zealand. Just a warning, some content in this story might be distressing to some listeners. Immigration reporter Jill Bonnet has more.
I was crying, and that drove him mad. She's not coming to a wedding, she's coming to a funeral.
Iman was married against her will to a man who abused her. She later survived near starvation in Palestine before escaping back to New Zealand. But she still wasn't safe. Her husband followed her. I'm Jill Bonnet with another episode of Voices.
Middle Eastern coffee always has cardamom, so.
Over a cup of coffee, Iman tells me her story. Iman was born in Kuwait, but came to Wellington as a refugee from the Gulf War when she was just 11. Her brother died young.
So when Saddam left Kuwait, they left guns, they left bombs, they left everything behind and just withdrew from Kuwait. There was constantly people just stepping on bombs and dying. And my brother was one of them. He was just 14 years old.
Iman's parents started looking into moving out of Kuwait. They're Palestinian, and as Palestine supported Saddam, they felt unwelcome in their home. Her father lost his job, and they thought about joining others in moving to Iraq. But Iman is thankful they didn't. Back then, New Zealand was able to offer them protection.
We were the first Palestinian people ever refugee in New Zealand. That was 1995. There was no other Palestinian refugees before us. I was 11 and my sister was 10. So I had another person with me that is going through the whole thing. It was way easier for me and my sister to settle than my parents. Like, I could remember my mom crying over like a year later. And she wants to go back to the Middle East because she couldn't speak the language. They had a different culture to her. But for me and my sister, we were just happy.
The family got citizenship, but storm clouds were gathering in her relationship with her parents.
Because I've challenged them before, they felt like they needed to take me to a place that if I challenged them, they wouldn't have to do this. Like, the whole culture would force me to basically obey and follow. So they took us to the Middle East. I was very upset and scared. I didn't want to go there. I knew a little bit about the culture there, and that frightened me. You know, women can't speak up, can't stand up for themselves, have no rights, no jobs. I've always wanted to have a job.
Iman was 15 and had no idea the trip would end in marriage.
So as soon as we went there, she started bringing suitors and actually nagging over my dad's head to agree. And my dad didn't agree. I would have been married like 15, 16, yeah. But my dad made the decision that I have to finish high school before deciding to get married.
Iman struggled to speak in Arabic and to deal with the strict education and difficult curriculum. Meanwhile, her mother was still determined she should marry.
So the tradition is a male would propose and parents would agree. So every time, like, she would meet a woman that has sons, she would tell them, yes, I have daughters. It's like selling and buying trades. Every time she would come across a woman that she would think, oh, that's a good suitor, she would tell them and she would bring them over and she would force me to go out and say hi to the woman. And I just refused. Like, I would tell her, no, I'm not going out. I would lock my room. It was 3 years that she just kept trying.
More than 30 men were brought to the house. But eventually her parents lost patience and Iman lost the right to choose.
At that time, it just got really, really bad for me that they had to force me to get married. I was forced because my sister, the younger one, got married and I didn't. So people were like, why is the younger one getting married and not the older one? There must be a problem there. I don't want to get married. I wanted to go to uni.
When Iman found out her parents had chosen someone for her, she was devastated.
I cried my eyes out, but I had no other choice. I couldn't do anything about it.
How long did you cry for?
So I was engaged 9 months throughout the 9 months. Yeah. Even on the wedding day. Like, you know, party and everything. And I was crying. And that drove him mad, the man that I married. The groom started screaming at me. He's like, she's not coming to a wedding, she's coming to a funeral. He literally said that to me.
Iman was 18.
So when I came to New Zealand, I absorbed all of the Kiwi culture very easily, and it became my culture. So getting married like that was just not acceptable to me.
Iman and her new husband, Mohammed, moved into an apartment in Palestine where his parents and five older brothers lived.
Straight away, they wanted to teach me a lesson. They wanted to change me. He used to always tell me that my parents didn't raise me well and he will wipe that and make me behave the right way. I could see him, like, clenching his fist, biting his jaw so hard, like, and his nostrils flaring, kind of, you know, like, you could see anger that he's barely holding it. And I did tell my mom, I did tell her, he doesn't seem right. Like, he it seems like it's gonna go downhill. She didn't listen to me, and she went through with it, the engagement and wedding. But as soon as I got married, like, it didn't take a week before he laid a hand on me. There are big events, like, where I've got huge bruises and stuff like that, but, like, getting a slap was just an everyday thing. Yeah, it was just, yeah, every time I opened my mouth, I just got a slap. I remember at one stage he held a knife to my throat, and then he snapped out of it. Like, he was just lost it, and he got a knife and put it on my throat, and then he threw the knife away, picked me up and threw me against the wall, and I've got bruises that day all over my side. One day he left me without food 2 days. I was in eight months pregnant. I was like big. He left me without food for 2 days and I wasn't allowed to go out of the house and I had no phone to contact like my parents to get me food or anything. And that was a punishment because I said I wanted to see my sister. I wasn't allowed to see my sister.
In 2004, Iman had a daughter and 3 years later, a son. The children weren't immune to the violence either.
He strangled my daughter a few times because she was crying and he couldn't handle her crying. So he suffocated her and strangled her on a few occasions to stop her crying.
A year after her son was born, Iman and her children fled Palestine and flew to New Zealand.
Around mid-2008, the war got very, very bad. Israelis have cut off electricity because there were people throwing bombs and things like that on Israelis. We were running low on everything, diapers. I was still breastfeeding, which helped, but I wasn't eating, so it was drying up. There was no formula. There was no baby food. In the end of the day, we were basically living on porridge, but wasn't enough nutrition. And we had noodles. We were gonna just starve in the end. So I told him, we need a solution. This is not gonna work out. We're gonna die. And the first is gonna go is my son because there is no food. He came around to the idea of letting me go back to New Zealand.
Iman had to agree to sponsoring her husband, which she did on the promise he would change. She left the Middle East with her children in 2009. Mohammed joined her in New Zealand a few months later.
And all of a sudden, I hear a knock on the door. I was going to uni, and all of a sudden, I hear a knock on the door. And his voice calling my kid's name. I was so in shock and frightened. It was unbelievable. He was, like, calm the first day. The second day, he started asking too many questions. The third day, he started threatening that if I don't come around and talk to him and, like, treat him as if he is my husband, he's gonna shoot me in the head in front of my parents and my children. Well, I jumped out of the window that day and ran away from the house and called the lawyer and told her this is what's going on. She put me through to the women's refuge. Women's refuge came to me at the supermarket car park, and they brought the police too, and we went to the house, got the kids, got a change of clothes, and they took me to a safe house. I lived with them for like 2 weeks before I got my protection order finalized. And yeah, and he was served the protection order without notice, of course. And he was told to move out because I didn't want him. I didn't want him to live anywhere near me. The police took him out of the house.
Immigration advised Iman to get her husband a work visa so that he could see the children, but she could cancel her sponsorship if things turned out badly. Mohammed managed to get residence in the end, but continued to make Iman's life a misery. He took complaints against her to the family court, failed to see their children when he was meant to, and then once he got citizenship, he just left the country. That was more than 4 years ago. Iman doesn't know where he is, but she thinks he's somewhere in the Middle East. The charity Shakti has worked with about 300 cases of forced marriage, and only about 10% of women in domestic violence situations use a woman's refuge. While young women can't be forced into marriage here, there's no power to stop parents taking their children to another country to get married. Iman worries about them. Iman finished her business degree in 2015, all while raising two children. Now, free of her violent husband and having moved into her own home in Wellington, Iman's concentrating on building her career. But she still fears other girls who have grown up in New Zealand will continue to find themselves taken to the Middle East or elsewhere and married against their will.
The story was by immigration reporter Jill Bonnet and produced by me, Saravui Tillatu. The engineers were Jeremy Veal and Flo Wilson. Subscribe to every episode of Voices at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Radio Public, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find us at rnz.co.nz. And while you are there, rate us. That way more people get to hear these stories. There are other podcasts you can hear too, like Killjoy, a fresh take on the true crime genre, and the Aotearoa History Show for a look at our country's colourful past. Thanks for listening. Ka kite anō.